Afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Tony, and you are listening to Tales from the Couch Zone. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm knackered.
Oh?
As they say in the UK.
Explain.
Well, basically, I've been away for a few weeks in the greatest city in the world, Las Vegas. So, and I only got back on Friday. So... and I've got to go to work tomorrow, which is going to be interesting. So yeah, I'm pretty shattered after having a great time.
Yeah, that explains to folks why we haven't had a Tales from the Couch Zone in quite a while.
That's true.
Because you've been in siesta.
Yeah, in Las Vegas.
Living it up in Las Vegas.
Yeah, where we actually met for the first time ever.
Yeah, here's the thing. Dazza and I do this show just about every week. And we do it from literally from different sides of the globe, and we've never met. Up until, I think it was 2 weeks ago, right?
Well, just over a week, because it was last week. It seems
that's
a long time
right.
ago. It was
that's
last week, and you came up to Vegas.
Correct.
And we ran into each other.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, because I didn't know it was you.
Yeah, but you know what? Like I said, I've met several people that I've done either radio shows with, or just people from the site, the Wrestling Observer site. You were the most friendly, nicest person that I've met. Now, obviously, I do another podcast with obviously who I, you know, obviously my friends, Dave and Alex. They're great and all, and I've met Dave. Dave's a cool guy. We have a lot more in common, but you and me, Daz, I felt like we had a better kinship, a better, you know, back and forth repertoire.
It was really strange, because just to explain what actually happened is that, because I knew that there was a possibility you were in town, but you were quite sort of vague about if you were going to go or not. And I turned up to a meal. I didn't actually go to a meal. I just came to say hi to a few people who were going to it. And then this, this young guy comes up to me and says, "Oh, I'm Tony." I said, "Oh, I'm Dazza." And then, but see, the thing is, this is what happens when you have when you only photograph on Facebook is when you're wearing sunglasses and sort of shouting in the photo. It's hard to recognize you. So I didn't actually know. So you just said Tony, and it was just like, oh, yeah, it's a new guy. And then it just sort of like figured, you sort of laughed, and I sort of got, you know, because your voice sounds different in person.
Yeah, as most people do. Often you'll hear people who have often been on the radio, and you'll meet them in real life, and they don't, like the voice on the air doesn't match what you're hearing speaking to you right in front of you. No,
what does match is your laugh. Yeah. And you can't, and then I just sort of like stood there for, hold on, is this Tony Galvin, my co-host, and that? So I actually sort of said to you.
Well, here's the reason why I just brushed it off when you just sort of just dismissed it. Cause you were meeting a lot of people from the Observer site. You were meeting obviously the big wigs, Brian Alvarez, Dave Meltzer, Vince Fairhigh, obviously, you know, these big names, tons of people from the message board. So obviously you're being inundated with all these names, all these people. And really, honest to God, this show is kind of a big deal, but really in retrospect, like the idea of you meeting the famed Wrestling Observer journalist, Dave Meltzer, I'm like, that kind of dwarfs meeting me.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm not really, when I go to a, I'm not there to basically suck up to the, you know, the big name journalists. I'm there to meet up with the people who I get on with and sort of, you know, can have a chat through and stuff like that. And Dave Meltzer, you know, is great at what he does, but he's not somebody that I basically have more than like two words to say to in a conversation, to be perfectly honest.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I get on better with the Vince Verheyes, the Ed Laredos, you know, as opposed to the sort of like, you know, the seasoned and well respected, grown up journalists, shall we say.
Well, that's what I was getting as well. We've known each other for about maybe a year and change. Whereas you've known Vincent Verhey, and you know Ed Laredo for, I'd say, a significantly more amount of time. So the idea that you're in Las Vegas, you're meeting all these people, shaking all these hands, you know, these people that you've known for years, obviously you're going to take priority. And the fact that you're finally meeting your podcast partner, you're like, okay, I'm meeting a lot of people. There's a lot of things going on in Vegas. My head's spinning. The idea that I'm meeting my podcast co-host, it's like, oh, that's really cool. But really, considering the weekend I've had, it's like, it's so much to fit in your brain in a couple of weeks. So it could be overwhelming. And that's the way I construed it when you finally met me.
No, it was just, I did not. When you said Tony, it just didn't click for a second. That is basically it. And plus as well, there's another Tony there as well, who I don't think I've actually ever met, but I know of. So, you know, I probably thought, it, you know, got you confused with him and everything. But once we knew we were all good and that. And we sort of, you know, we got together the next day and stuff and, you know, we had a fun time.
Yes, you did many a thing in Las Vegas. In fact, you were telling me you were there the week prior to the Wrestling Observer Convention.
Yeah, I always go for 2 weeks because the amount of money for me, the big expense is the plane ride over. So when you've actually paid all that out, I've already, you know, paid out, you know, a lot of money. So to actually be there for like say 5 days or 2 weeks, it's on the scheme of things, it's not that much more with what I've already paid out. So I always, this isn't like, for some people, this is kind of like, you know, a getaway for like a weekend. This is like my holiday for the year. So I always make a big deal of it, you know, and I always sort of go a bit before everybody else so I can do a few things. And it, you know, I got to go see a Steven Tyler in concert, which I didn't even know he was there until I got there. He was doing it one night in the Venetian. So I went there. I went to see Bryan Adams. I went to see some other shows. Went to see a couple of Cirque du Soleil shows. Went to see a Raiding the Rock Vault, which is like a, you know, a really big sort of like, you know, rock tribute night. Just loads of stuff like that. There's just so much to do in Vegas. And even if it's just sort of like, you know, going to a bar and watching like, you know, sport and with a few drinks and stuff, it's, you know, I am never at a loss for things to do in Vegas. So, you know, so I always make a big deal of it. But yeah, I had a great time. It was pretty much awesome. As always.
You had a very busy weekend considering it was International Fight Week. Let's talk about some of the things you did while you were there.
Yeah, the one show out of the three that I decided to go to, we'll come to that when we come to 200, is I went to the Ultimate Fighter finale.
Did you go the night before with Eddie Alvarez and Rafael Dos Anjos?
No.
Oh, okay.
That was the first day that a lot of people were getting in. So we kind of basically just like, on the first, I'm trying to remember what we did. I think we basically just like pretty much just walked the strip, and basically just sort of went bar hopping and that sort of thing and sort of just having a good time. So I kind of wasn't into UFC that night. I was more into, catching up. But to be honest, the big fight I wanted to see all weekend was the strawweight title fight between Joanna Jędrzejczyk and Claudia Gadela.
Can I applaud you for pronouncing the name properly, by the way, her last name?
Oh, of course.
When I take into consideration both names, those are, yeah. Those are
perfectly tied. Do you know a secret?
Okay, what's the
I actually, just before we came on, I actually listened to an interview with her on YouTube, and then I wrote it phonetically on my laptop, so I could just pass it off, like, you know. But that was a fight I really wanted to see because, you know, I'm a big fan of and supporter of, you know, women's MMA. I'd not seen her fight before. This was of all the matches that weekend, this was like the big grudge match. I mean, I've been watching the Ultimate Fighter season this year, and in the past, some of them have sort of like kind of gone off it. This one, I just love for the dynamic and everything, and I really got into a lot of competitors. But this was the fight I really wanted to see. And out of all the fights I saw this weekend, this was for me the most dramatic and the best one, because in the first two rounds, Claudia, you know, looked like she might pull off an upset. I mean, she sort of, you know, she actually, like, you know, knocked Joanna down a couple of times. And she was still taking down. She'd be, and then in the third round, she seemed to run out of steam. A lot of those that were watching, I actually thought she got injured because she seemed to suddenly like a bit unsteady on the feet and stuff. But she says she was just sort of, you know, she just basically, just got tired really quick. And after that, it actually became quite brutal because she took, you know, some really big shots. I mean, Joanna, when she went to town, she lasted the distance, but it was a stage where she was really tearing her apart, you know, but it was like, you know, a really good fight. But, you know, Claudia, I think she won a lot of people over because she hung in there for, you know, she was so tough and brave, and actually, you know, she never once went down. She got taken down, but she never actually went down from punches. But yeah, it was just a really, you know, dramatic, you know, good title match. And, you know, for me, it was one of the highlights of the weekend. Did you see that fight?
I caught the highlights the night of. I think what my original plan was, I didn't know how many people had originally bought their tickets. And, you know, I was already on the fence on whether or not I was going to go to Las Vegas or not. But when I saw the prices for this event, I was like, sure, why not? If somebody else hasn't purchased their tickets yet, I'll go along. But when we finally sat down for the dinner at Boca de Bibo, and folks that were going already had their tickets, I'm like, well, I think maybe because I've a couple of months ago, I did in fact go see UFC live. So I'm like, you know what? My UFC live fix is sort of, I'm good for a while. So the idea of shelling out more money, I'm like, didn't really appeal to me. But I'm like, you know what? I'll catch the replay. I'll catch some highlights later. I'm in Las Vegas. Let's check out the area. I know Dazza recommended a comic book store. I checked that one out. I also checked out Cosmic Comics, which I absolutely recommend. It's the biggest in the state. I did that. And then also, you know, take into consideration, I'd worked an 8-hour shift before making the trip to Las Vegas. And then after doing that, I was exhausted. So, like I said, I caught a couple of the highlights the night of, as before I was going to bed. I know a couple of you guys went to a pub later. And then I think you guys had some kind of post-UFC meetup. And just by then, I was just so exhausted. And I didn't get the information on it, the Facebook group thing until after, and I just said, forget it, I'm just going to go to bed. So it's one of those things to where, obviously, I was looking forward to all the events that weekend. The obviously, the Alvarez Dos Anjos fight, I saw the highlights of that. That looked amazing. That was a great resultant fight. I saw the highlights of the Joanne, Claudia?
I think it's Claudia Gadela.
Okay. I saw the highlights of that, and that looked amazing. I since gone back and watched the entire fight. This was a fantastic weekend for fights, all things considered. So, we were being treated. In fact, my only complaint is now that weekend's over, it's kind of a dry spell for MMA, at least for a while, considering, you know, all the big fights they put on International Fight Week. But that pretty much does it for all the fight nights leading up to the main event of the weekend, UFC 200.
Which I just got to mention something else about the Ultimate Fighter finale. There was I don't know if this actually came across on the TV as much. A young lad by the name of Do Ho Choi, who was a Korean featherweight, and he was on the Fox card. No one cared about this guy going in. No one even knew him or anything. And he came out, first of all, he came out to the Superman music, the Christopher Reeve music. And he's actually, I think his nickname is like the Korean Superboy or something. And he came out with this big smile on his face. And he just looked so, you know, he looked a young lad. He just looked so happy to be there. And he's waving to the crowd, just like this big smile on his face. And immediately he warmed himself to everybody. And then he got into the fight. And then there's a moment in the fight where the other guy was basically sort of taking him down, trying to sort of work his position. And the camera sort of was on it. And the expression on his face was this sort of like nonplussed, mild look on his face. You know, totally calm, totally relaxed. And then he actually, when he got back standing, he actually knocked his opponent out, Thiago Tavares, with a 1-2. This really quick 1-2, but just knocked the guy out. The entire audience just fell in love with this kid, you know, because he just came out, just had a big smile on his face, just had like a really nice personality, came out with Superman music. And it was just amazing that basically this guy who, you know, none of us knew him, none of us cared. And by the end of it, he got a standing ovation. It was like the perfect way for someone to ingratiate themselves with the crowd.
Awesome. I have to go back and watch that now.
Yeah. The trouble is, I think on the TV, because sometimes we actually cut the entrances out. So I don't know if you can actually still see the entrance, but straight away, this guy just had such that personality that people just basically really took to the heart. you know, it was incredible. And this sort of, you know, the reaction to him when he won, you know, was, it was just wonderful. Everybody just, you know, just fell in love with this kid.
I thought the way Fight Pass worked is they would show you all the entrances. Am I misinterpreting that?
If we replay it on Fight Pass, they probably will. I don't know if this sort of like how long it is before we show it on, because this was a Fox card. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how long it is before we actually show the replay on Fight Pass. But I know Fox, apart from the main event, they tend to basically just cut straight to them in the ring. You know, so. You know.
Okay, if I do some snooping on the internet, I'm sure eventually I'll find it.
I'm sure you'll be able to, you know, pull the whole thing. But yeah, this was sort of like, you know, this was one of the highlights of the show. This was just one of those, right, you know, weird things that just basically caught everybody's imagination.
Okay, that's cool. That's one something I may have to go investigate now, because this sounds awesome. All right. Like I said before, UFC 200. Now, I know neither you or I actually attended this live. I think your justification was it was too expensive, and as it was, there were a bunch of people that you were already meeting up there. They were going to have a big sweet party. And how was that sweet party?
That was great, because, I mean, part of the reason was... I've been to a lot of shows in that, the UFC 200, originally, if it was going to be Diaz and Conor, which was the original plan, I probably would have gone. Mm-hmm. But there was no sort of like, you know, key match on this card that was sort of like something that I felt I really had to see. And the thing is, I probably would have gone, but what swayed it is that a load of people who was in Vegas with basically they basically got a suite and then basically hire the thing on the big screen. So I thought it was like, I'd never actually done that before. So I thought this would be a sort of good chance for me to basically do something a little bit different, have a bit of a party, but also hang around with some people who I don't normally get to go to the fights with, because there's people who basically go to the convention and aren't really interested in UFC. But were interesting in actually watching them in the suite. So I got to like watch the fights with people who I don't normally get to watch fights with. So that was fun. And the party was great. You know, it was like a real good atmosphere. Somebody bought a load of pizza. We all did a load of booze. And it was just like a really nice, relaxing. I have to admit, when it was coming up to the card and I was seeing like the new arena and all the hype and everything. And then of course Brock got put onto the card. Mm-hmm. I was kind of sort of starting to think, oh, I wish I was going now and stuff. but when it was over, there was no real sort of like big moment that I thought, God, I wish I could have been there live. You know, but there was no sort of like, you know, really sort of like, you know, dramatic. You know, like the stuff I've seen before, I've seen Silva get knocked out by Weidman, which was a complete shock. You know, I saw Sonnen Silva too. I've seen Rousey fight. I saw McGregor and last year win the title. I've seen all those great moments, and there was nothing on here that I was sort of like could ever match with those. Mm. You know what I mean? So I was kind of, you know, and also as well, but if I had gone, the reason I would have wanted to go to see would have been to see people like Misha Tate fight live, Kat Zingano, and a big fight fan of live, and they all lost. So to be perfectly honest, I was happy with the decision that I made in actually going to a sweet party and watching this. And it was really fun because it was kind of like a lot of pro wrestling fans in the sweet party who were basically really, really cheering on Brock and everything and stuff. So it was a really fun, but as a show, there wasn't a great deal on there that I found that exciting, but the fight, there were a lot of big names on there, but not many of the fights actually delivered. Perfectly. I mean, the Brock was sort of exciting for what it was in the sort of Randy Couture and Tim Sylvia sort of way. It was not a great fight, but the personalities made it. But generally speaking, there wasn't really any sort of like really great fights on there. I mean, to be honest, quite a few of them were really boring. I mean,
although you could argue that Amanda Nunes, Misha Tate fight was in fact entertaining.
That was dramatic you know, and a shocker. And also I did get a really big kick out of Cain Velasquez totally smashing the living daylights out of Travis Brown. that I enjoyed. I really enjoyed
that. I'm curious why, Dazza?
Because Travis Brown is a piece of crap. If there are things he has done which allegedly he has done, then basically I would watch him get beat every single day of my life. You know,
allegedly.
Not a good person. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the Cormier Silver fight was sort of, again, there was, you know, other circumstances that sort of played into that a bit, but that wasn't, you know, really exciting. Aldo and Edgar, I didn't really find exciting at all. It wasn't a car that I really felt I had to be there. It wasn't afterwards that I felt I had to be there live for. It was just sort of, you know, it was just like, you know, a big name, big event card. I was happy with watching it with all my friends and sort of having some beers and having pizza. That to me, I enjoyed.
Okay.
I mean, the big stuff happened, you know, outside of the cage, to be honest, this weekend.
Yes. Above which being, obviously, since before, and actually now that we're talking about it, after the show, we had two gigantic drug failures.
Yeah. The John Jones ones. I was actually meeting up with some friends who they were just arriving. So I was waiting in the Excalibur, and I would just happened to be at a bar, and I could see a TV from where I was, and I just saw Dana White on the screen, and underneath it the banner. I just caught a glimpse of John Jones out, and it was like, oh my god, now. And when I saw that it was like, you know, a suspected drug failure, there are some people in this world who are basically just perpetual screw ups.
I'm not okay. Here's a point that no one's brought up so far. Daz, do you know why John Jones is a UFC fighter?
Well, because he's a great fighter.
No, do you know why he's in this line of work?
No.
This is the thing.
What if his reason is? I'm guessing I don't know, because I'm not sure where you're leading with
this. This is something I think everyone has forgotten. The reason why he's gone to this kind of line of work, because I think originally he was attending college, and he had to pull out of college. You know why? Because he got a girl knocked up.
Right.
And he had to provide for his family. Or his new family. So this is a guy who, even before he stepped inside the cage, is a screw up. The idea that you give him all this money, he achieves all these things, that he's still not going to be that screw up at the end of the day, doesn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form. And to me, considering all the things that have been written about Jones, all the things that have been said, no one brings that up.
I've got to admit, I don't know that story. Things like that happen in your early life, but it's the sort of thing that sort of leads, you know, to the stuff that is happening, you know,
later. I'm saying there's a pattern there. Before he even stepped into the cage. So the idea that something like this would happen to the guy doesn't really surprise me. To quote one Nate Diaz, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, he failed the cocaine test before. He basically, there was the hit and run incident. There was another time when he basically pretty much refused. I can't remember what the details were, but it was one of the shows when the opponent basically sort of dropped out, and he pretty much Chael Sonnen stepped up.
It was Henderson fight.
Yes.
And Dan Henderson bowed out due to injury, and Chael Sonnen was a last-minute replacement, and John Jones refused to fight Chael.
And they had to scrap the entire card.
Yeah, many people were of the idea, it's like, this is an easy win for Jones. He should have just took the fight. He should have saved the pay-per-view. It would have been better for everybody.
Yeah, that was sort of one of those acts of sort of like real selfishness, because it basically screwed over the fans who wanted to see a card. It screwed over all the fighters on that card, because they basically, you know, the loss of a thing. Obviously screwed over promotion. It was one of those things where you see that and the sort of thing that sort of, you know, going to his head. And you're right. It's the person who he would have been fighting was Chael Sonnen at late notice. I mean, you know, it was an easy fight, and you saw what sort of, you know, the comparison with what happened with Cormier, you know, taking the, you know, the Silver fight, and Silver sort of stepping up, you know, people actually sort of, you know, doing something for that. It's just, and it's there was the whole business then, like I said, with the other failures and having to be stripped of the title and that old ridiculous thing where he went into rehab, then came out the day after. Did he actually last the day? I thought it came out the same day, or was it the next day? In any case, it was basically like, you know, a really, really quick thing. But there was the incident with the sort of, you know, with the brawl with Cormier, which you can say that, you know, that there's two of them together. But again, it's that sort of pattern. You know, the guy is just, you know, an absolute screw up. And some people defend him and say it's because he's had all this thrown at him at an early age and he's sort of, you know, and but he's been put in a privileged position, mm-hmm. you know, to basically, you know, to, he's got, you know, he's that athletically gifted star. He's got all this money, you know. I mean, people say, you know, all the pressures of the sort of the fame and the money, you know, but to me, there's more pressure in being sort of, you know, a young man and having no money and having no sort of like, you know, so, and having to sort of make your way in a career without all those gifts that he's been given, mm-hmm. you know. It's just a complete arrogance on his part, but he's basically got all that and just basically thrown it away time and time again. I mean, you screw up once massively and be a black eye for the company. You think from this point on, you're going to basically tow everything down the line. You know, you're going to say, right, I'm going to sort myself out now. You know, I've had my screw up. From now on, I'm going to be a model person, model employee, not going to take the drugs, not going to get into these situations. And, you know, there was even last year that when he was pulled over by police.
Oh, and he's mouthing off to the police, yeah.
Yeah. And he, and again, it's one of these things that you think somebody with all that money, why are they driving themselves anyway? You know, the thing is, he's probably going to be gone for a long time. He's probably, you know, there's sort of talk it could be like, you know, 2 years or something like that. But even if he comes back and UFC basically take him on, can we ever trust him again?
I
would say they're going to put him on, they're going to have it as like a double main event card because you can't, you know, I mean, I'm serious. You know, yeah, you can't basically have him being sort of like, you know, the key, element on a card without having another match on there because, you know, there's a very good chance that he's going to screw up sometime and be off the card.
Yeah. Cause you could say maybe he had his come to Jesus moment, but how many has he had? Now, obviously, the biggest one being the hit and run. And you think that would have been the one where he finally would have got his act together.
Because that's where he could have killed somebody.
One of the people in the hit and run was a pregnant yeah. woman.
Hmm. That you would think would shock you into. And obviously, what he's done, failing the drug test since then is not as, but there's been incidents since then. And then the, you're failing the drug test and, you know, he's sort of coming out and saying that, he's not done anything wrong and crying on the, crying at the press conference and everything like that. But it just comes across now as so insincere. And I'm guessing UFC will probably, you know, give him another shot because he is such, you know, a talented fighter and everything. But it's just, you just lose. I mean, in this country, there's a footballer called Paul Gascoigne.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most talented, soccer players, as you guys call him, that you would ever see. Just naturally gifted. He's sort of, you know, the things he can do kicking a football, it's almost unreal. But he was, you know, just a massive screw up. It was a drinker, you know, a partier. He basically, you know, was surrounded by, you know, lots of sort of friends who were basically would sort of get him, you know, who were the sort of people who basically would not really keep him on the straight and narrow, shall we say. And he was the sort of person that basically he would sort of, you know, he would basically go into rehab time and time again, and then he would slip off and just make embarrassments of himself. And he just gets to a point where he's got all that talent, yet there's just some that and everything in his life that you would want to be like, you know, a star, a sports star, and, you know, rich, having like a comfortable life. But there's just that thing in his life. It just cannot basically sort of stop himself from doing really stupid stuff.
It's to the point where you have to sit with these people. You look at their lives and really the talent, the God-given talents they're given. And you look at it and you look at the decisions they make. And it's kind of a curse.
Yeah.
Like having all these abilities, what good does it do them if all it does is enable them to do terrible things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And here's the part that's the most disturbing. Unlike certain people who wear 2 years that's a lifetime when you consider their career. Or in several instances, that's the end of their career. Cause they're pushing on 40, and 2 years is literally, you might as well just wrap up your career. Cause after 2 years, you're not gonna be able to compete anymore. John Jones is 28. In 2 years, he's gonna be 30. He's not even gonna be at his peak. That's a little scary to think about. To think all the screw ups that he's done. And UFC's, you know, they're in a position where obviously they can condemn all they want. They're obviously gonna hedge their bets whenever they put John Jones on a card. But at the same time, with his abilities, you have to, and he with his abilities and his ability to draw, you kind of have to use him.
You know what, Bill? What you said is right with his age. I actually think we sort of, you know, he may have, you know, you don't know how people age with the gifts that they've got. You know, so when he gets to 30, he may basically sort of like, you know, his skills may have started to deteriorate. Something you've got to remember. Let's say he's out for 2 years. Okay. First of all, because of the new rules, he cannot train.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because of the new rules, and because Coughlin's wrote a lot about this, and as I understand it, he basically cannot train MMA for the next 2 years. So he can't basically go into any gyms and train as MMA. Obviously, he can basically go into like a regular gym and do his cardio and everything like that.
But then here's the problem with that too. It's like, how do you enforce something like that? Are you literally having someone there follow Jones, make sure he doesn't train?
Anyone who would be caught training with him would get suspended.
Oh, okay.
So obviously he's got a big house. There's nothing to stop people coming around to his house for allegedly, like, you know, for dinner and then training. But it's not the same as being like at a camp. You know, it's going to be, you know, and he's obviously not going to be earning money in that time and stuff. But here's the point. So basically, let's just say that's correct. And he can't basically train MMA for the next 2 years. He's got, this is John Jones, who basically, even when he is in training and a fighter, is doing all this really, really stupid shit. What do you think he's going to be like with 2 years of time on his hands?
Well, I have to imagine at least for a couple of months he'll fly for right.
For a couple of months. And then you've got basically, you know, do you think he's basically going to basically, you know, sit around sort of, you know, reading, jogging and stuff for the next 2 years? If he's like that when he's actually in training and doing that sort of thing, what's it going to be, you know, in the next 2 years, chances are it's going to screw up somehow. He's going to like maybe go out partying, get into that. I basically think, you know, this, I would be, you know, I think that this could be the end of him.
Yeah. In fact, I was joking earlier when initially, I think it was April, John Jones and Daniel Cormier was supposed to fight. And obviously Daniel Cormier had to bow out due to injury. But I sort of joked to myself, which one, I bet Daniel Cormier faked the injury because he knew eventually John Jones would screw up again. He wouldn't have to fight him.
Now Cormier wanted this fight though, because it was like, you know, big money.
It was big money, but then also with him as light heavyweight champion, it's always going to have that asterisk because he never did go out there and beat John Jones.
Yeah, but I do think if you see the footage of when Dana actually spoke to Cormier, because he actually filmed that from a distance, and the look on his face, he was a gutter, and from all accounts, he was absolutely devastated. But there was another point I was just to make about that, and it's completely.
It's okay. I still have several more points to make. You were bringing up earlier that in 2 years, who's to say that we're still going to have the same John Jones that went out there and just absolutely cleaned out the division at 205? That's true. He can't formally train. And on top of that, this drug failure kind of taints his legacy to a degree. You wonder, you know, he now recently got popped with USADA testing, but you have to wonder, how long has he been using, you know, performance enhancing drugs to help him win those fights, especially when you're talking about those razor thin decisions, especially in the Gustafson fight? You have to wonder, you know, was he on drugs then? Was he on drugs when he beat Shogun for the title? Was he on drugs when he went out there and beat Daniel Cormier? And who's to say, being off the drugs for so long, maybe that was sort part of a key to his success was these performance enhancing drugs. And when he comes back in 2 years after not training, after having to be clean for 2 years, who's to say that we're not going to get a completely different John Jones?
Yeah. I think when it comes to legacy is, UFC fans seem to be quite forgiving of drugs. They seem to be, you know, once people are sort of serve a suspension, they basically seem to sort of like, you know, forget about the drugs things. You know, I mean, Silver, everyone was sort of, you know, cheering, and he sort of had a drug failure not so long ago and stuff. So I think, you know, fans are very sort of fickle.
I'm curious what your perspective is, because for me, I could sort of justify as an American, but I'm curious as an Englishman, what's your take on something like this?
What, in the drugs?
Because you said, you know, obviously Americans have a different perspective. Two things. We love a comeback story. We love a redemption story. But that at the end of the day, we like a winner. And I remember you and I have had this debate back and forth. I haven't defended it, but I sort of justified it. You were wondering why people booed Daniel Cormier over John Jones, considering Daniel Cormier has been nothing but a model citizen. And I'm telling you, and I think we have this discussion before in the past, Americans are willing to overlook a lot of things if you're a winner. Or you're perceived to be a winner and a big success. And I think that's why they were willing to cheer John Jones over Daniel Cormier. So I'm curious what your perspective is as an Englishman. Someone who isn't from, obviously embedded with a culture, who obviously you're sort of you're out looking in. I'm curious, what's your perspective on that? Because I know you're very critical of the people that boo Daniel Cormier. So...
I mean, me personally, I've got to admit, I basically a lot of the time like to see underdogs beat the top guys. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really into the sort of that because someone sort of, I like to have guys who are basically, you know, or women who are basically sort of dominate their sport for a while and be a big name. But to me, it's sort of like to build to someone beating them and getting that, you know, sort of moment. I mean, I've got to admit, I sort of, as a fight fan, just for example, I tend to put my support back behind the ones who I like how they come across as people. Mm-hmm. So for example, I mean, I said it before, you know, one of my favorite fighters is Kat Zingano. Mm-hmm. And it's not because she was sort of like, you know, it's not because I think she's like, you know, the greatest fighter in the world. I think she's a really good fighter, but the part is that the way she comes across in interviews and stuff, she comes across as, you know, a nice person. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of will sort of, you know, and it's, you know, it's the same in, or somebody who is basically flamboyant. And so, for example, Chael Sonnen. I was sort of, you know, sort of, even though he's sort of a bit of a drugs thing, you know, I go more for personalities than for someone, you know, than for being saying that I'm like, you know, supporting a winner.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So that's kind of, if that's what you imply, but you're getting done, that's what I sort of go, you know, when it comes to the drug thing, I've got to say I'm probably a hypocrite on that because I will sort of cheer someone like Chael Sonnen over Anderson Silva in their second fight, even though knowing that Chael Sonnen basically, you know, took performance enhancing drugs in that first fight. And at the time, Anderson Silva was basically never failed anything, whether he was clean or not, you know, we don't know. Cause if you look at the press conference with Nate Diaz a few weeks, he basically said everyone's on steroids. So, you know. So,
well, with that kind of statement, especially when you consider the source, you have to take it with a grain of salt.
I personally don't, you know, believe that. But, I basically go on personalities more. And, the reason why I sort of, you know, don't like John Jones, I think he's an arrogant, you know, person. I think he comes across as really nasty. And I think the stuff that he's done is really bad. And also, I personally think he basically, you know, doesn't take any responsibility for the stuff he does. And I hate fans' reactions to him as well. The fact that I remember seeing him at a press conference after all this, and there was people asking questions and people sort of praise him, say, you know, you're such an inspiration to us because you're turning your life around and you're sort of, you know, you're fallen, but you're sort of, you know, you're getting yourself back up in that. It's like, well, you know, is it really inspiring that someone sort of, you know, gets himself into a bad situation and then gets himself, out of it himself. That's to me, that's just, you know, what you should do. You shouldn't really deserve credit for that.
you shouldn't throw a parade for a guy being a decent person, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Chris Rock does a whole routine about that. I won't sort of try and emulate, but he basically does the same thing. How men are always wanting credit for stuff that they do, like guys will say stuff like, I've never been in prison or anything like that, or been in trouble with police. And he's saying, well, what do you want, a cookie? You're not supposed to go to prison or be in trouble. That's a bad thing to do. it's just that sort of, but I find that people who basically sort of make, messes of them, of their lives, seem to basically sort of, get more credit for pulling themselves out, as opposed to people who basically, show restraint and actually sort of, live the life how it should be lived. And, with sort of like, integrity and everything. They seem to have seen as sort of like, as like, goody two shoes as what it was. Whereas people who basically, support the Mike Tysons of this world, who basically sort of like, basically make really, really bad choices and screw up their lives somewhat, and basically get sort of like, people supporting them, because they, manage to pull themselves out of situations that they've created themselves. But that's just me.
All right. I think that's going to do it, unless there's anything else you want to talk about that's in the news as of late. Oh, well, I can't believe we forgot with the 400-pound gorilla in the room.
Well, what was really funny about that is I went to an open workout. I wanted to see the new arena, and him and Hamarko were doing open workouts and interviews, and people basically asked him the question of, obviously, what do you think of what's happened to John Jones? And he basically was sort of like saying how it was like, unprofessional, and how he basically sort of like, he basically let down the fans and everybody in the company and everything. And then, just last week, it turned out that he'd also failed a drugs test.
You're referring to Brock Lesnar.
Brock Lesnar, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't really make this one up. You've got the sort of, the card falling apart almost before the actual show itself happens because they lose John Jones, and then everyone says, "Oh well, thank God they added Brock Lesnar to this show." And then it turns out that Brock Lesnar as well has, well, basically, we don't know the details as yet, but it looks like there has been a violation, which they sort of, they've not sort of come out with what it is yet, but it's there is speculation of what this will be.
Yeah, so the news of which being obviously a potential violation.
Mm.
We have to dot our I's and cross our T's here. Obviously, nothing has been formally come out, but really, yeah, he's potentially violated, considering, like you said before, we had that statement ripping on John Jones, and people obviously have been joking for most of his life, if not his entire career. You look at Brock, and obviously, he's a guy that part of you thinks that can't be natural. For a guy to be that big?
I've got to admit, I'm not into this sort of looking at a guy and then saying, well, or a lady and then saying, well, they're on steroids, just how they look. Because, it doesn't translate like that to me. Some people are basically sort of like, gifted, genetically. And people sort of make these comments, also to make comments like, oh, well, you looked out, how the size of him at, press conferences that, and not really understanding how sort of like, steroids or PEDs or anything like that actually work.
That's true. You look back and you take the Wayback Machine, you look at Bruno Sammartino at his peak. You have to imagine this is maybe before the modern day of enhancement drugs, where you can obviously manipulate the way you look. You look at him and you would think, obviously, with 2016 eyes, he must have been on something. But I bet if you could do modern drug testing, I'm sure he wasn't. I agree. There is a degree to where some people are just naturally gifted and they're going to look a certain way no matter what.
Yeah. And so you can't, some people, and Brock Lesnar is basically, he's a genetic freak, So just looking at somebody from the way they look, that doesn't ring true with me. And also this whole thing that people have where they'll look at like photos from like a few years ago before testing came in and look at them now and stuff. people's bodies change, you know, people's basically, you know, their style of their sort of, you know, their workout regime and whatever, you know, their people's bodies do change. So that doesn't, you know, that never holds any water with me.
Yeah.
You know?
In fact, I'm making the devil's advocate argument. I'm taking both sides on this. You could make the argument, at the same time, you saw him just a couple months ago at WrestleMania and he looked about 20 pounds heavier. He looked gigantic. But then obviously the counter argument to it would be like, well, he's obviously cutting down to 265, so he literally can't look like that. So there's a reason why he does look smaller. But, go ahead.
The thing at the end of the day is this basically throws a massive spanner in the works of everything, because after this fight, you know, because our weight went over, people were talking about, well, you know, maybe there was some sort of talk I heard about basically him basically fighting again for UFC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and basically, you know, and it's sort of, you know, and it's becoming sort of like either, you know, maybe getting out of his WWE contract or do like a joint thing, you know, and that sort of, you know, and there was sort of like, you know, lots of talk on that. And that, you know, if his violation, if his second sample comes in, it's gone, you know, that's all scuppered. You know, and there's speculation now that possibly this could affect him in his WWE career, because if he basically fails, it could basically, you know, and SummerSlam, I believe, is in New York, and New York is actually sort of like, you know, a regulated state, but he could actually, you know, even though he's not failed for WWE, he may not be allowed to actually, you know, perform, shall we say, on that card.
At this point, nothing is for sure. We don't know all the details yet. This is something that where it's an ongoing thing. We don't know. Like you said before, because he tested positive for MMA drug, MMA violation, who's to say if that's going to carry over? Nothing's for sure. Like we don't know. As it is, you know, we're going with everybody else. We're learning this as we go, and we don't know if something like this will hurt his chances of competing at SummerSlam, or if maybe just from the PR nightmare they don't want to have Brock Lesnar featured at SummerSlam just because it looks bad on the company if you have someone who tested positive in an MMA environment. It's like, do you really want to feature them on obviously wrestling's not real, but at the same time it's like you still want to what's the word, support, reward someone like that. And obviously there's the idea of maybe you know, wait, give it some time, let it die down. We're on the wrong side of July here. August is just right around the corner. You're talking 4 weeks, 3 weeks. SummerSlam's going to be around the corner. It's
yeah.
Like, do you really still want that memory fresh in people's heads?
That said, who's on the main event on the card next week? on Battleground.
Well, according to that, that should make Brock Lesnar a sympathetic babyface, according to Vince McMahon.
Roman Reigns will had a violation a few weeks back. He's going to be on that card, so you know, I don't think WWE basically care much apart from any public relations.
And here's the thing: someone's brought up as well. They could suspend Brock for a month, 30 days. He'd still be able to make SummerSlam. So that's one of those things where it's like, it's just, there's no good option here for WWE.
Yeah.
But then, you know what? I will say this. People talk about what Brock Lesnar has meant to UFC. He's obviously a gigantic draw. He means so much for business. I'll be honest, for WWE, especially considering that they moved over to the network, Brock Lesnar is not really a difference maker, to be honest. I mean, it's one of those things cosmetically. It's nice, the idea that you have this big former MMA fighter on your roster, former UFC heavyweight champion. But we've seen the numbers, and I know you hate it when we talk like this, but this is sort of fitting the overall argument I'm trying to make. He's not really a difference maker. You could be, you know, you could do just fine without Brock Lesnar, not on SummerSlam.
Yeah, I know what you mean, because it's... And a guy, I don't know, often get into these talks, but nowadays, I sort of, you know, what is the worth of actual wrestlers? Because, you know, if a John Cena or Brock Lesnar was going to basically sort of like, you know, leave for a year or something like that, does that mean subscriptions are going to fall?
No.
Because that is their main, you know, their main income And obviously they've got these sort of live gates and everything, but, you know, replacing what you would have basically been the gauge, the money being, you know, the pay-per-view buy rates. I, you know, does that translate now that people will basically sort of, you know, that if they lose a couple of stars, that people will basically abandon the network? Or if they get like a big star in, will their subscriptions, you know, rise for that month? It's sort of, it's hard to gauge these sort of things nowadays. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I personally, I mean, whoever actually got him, wrestling at SummerSlam, Randy Orton, who's been out for ages, which, to be perfectly honest, I think is a bad match anyway. When you've got a guy who's had neck injuries, his first match back, he's going to have a guy who's basically, you know, who basically, you know, just throws opponents over, or, you know, over his shoulder and everything.
But placing into our bigger argument of all these people who've tested positive for drug tests, there's another guy right there.
Yeah. but with Brock, it's sort of, you know, they've done the title run, they've done the Undertaker match, and the sort of, you know, and the big sort of name matches. You know, I mean, it's always entertaining to watch because you don't get to see him that often, but there doesn't seem to be that the sort of, you know, the big matches to make use of a guy like that anymore. I mean, to be honest with you, that Randy Orton thing, just to talk fantasy booking, that's kind of a match that you would think that, you know, because they always have been very keen on Orton. They've always basically tried to push him into that sort of, you know, that top position, sometimes in the tight hole. To me, that would be a match that you would basically sort of like, you know, build up and down the line for like a WrestleMania. You know, it's not really such as just throw in there with just a couple of months build.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that's my thinking on that. But, you know, it's sort of, I just, when I look at Brock Lesnar, I don't see a lot of sort of, like, you know, big matches that you sort of, you know, that you can basically, you know, what I'm saying is there's not another big star that you have sort of, like, you know, a big dream match with anymore.
Well, for me, obviously, and you would never probably see this considering who's running WWE. I would like to see him in there with like a Samoa Joe or a Kevin Owens. But when you consider the way WWE books, like, are we ever going to see that match? Probably not. But I will say this: they've sort of run the gamut with Brock. But there was something to the novelty of him as the returning conquering hero who's gone back to UFC and won. To me, there was sort of an appeal to that. It's something they haven't done with Brock yet, but with this potential violation, it's like, well, that goes out the window now because you can't really do that now because, you know, it sort of negates everything that he did.
Mm, yeah.
and part of this story is, I don't know if you've since heard the reaction to Mark Hunt considering Brock Lesnar's potential failure.
Doesn't he want his? The only thing I've heard is that he basically wants Brock's purse.
He wants among things. He wants half of Brock's purse. He feels like he should be let out of his contract because he's of the opinion, and obviously he's being hyperbolic. But at the same time, he has some legitimate arguments. You know, thank God Brock didn't hurt him because really you could have made the argument. You know, considering Brock being all jacked up on performance enhancing drugs, he could have gotten out there and permanently hurt Hunt. And, you know, obviously he's being obviously hyperbolic, but there's some legitimacy behind that argument. And he's even brought up the fact that the last three guys he's fought have all been popped.
Hmm.
Let's see. I'm trying to think, because I know the one he's fought, Frank Mir, I think that was, what, two fights ago or the fight before this? So he did brought up the argument that the last three guys that he's fought have popped for, you know, performance enhancing drugs.
I wonder, just a devil's advocate, before we move on, because we've already talked a lot about this, but just to throw something in there, maybe it's something we could ask Mike Coughlin at some point. If a fighter was to get injured in a fight, and maybe this has happened, I've just missed it, but let's say that somebody got injured in a fight, and then the opponent, it turned out, had basically been on using performance-enhancing drugs, could they sue? Could they sue the opponent and maybe sue the organization if they were sort of, you know, had allowed a fight to happen?
Well, here's my counter argument to that. Would you want to sue? It's one of those things to where, yeah, They have every right to do it, but at the same time, especially if Hunt wins, it's like you have to wonder if like UFC would take offense to that, and they're like, okay, Hunt.
Yeah, but if you, let's say that you got injured. Okay, let's say that you like end of your career. Oh, if you got injured and could not fight again.
Ah, that's even better.
Yeah, if you basically don't, you know, basically don't care about fighting again, you know, could you sue?
That is a very good argument. This is something that maybe next week when we come back, we can either look to get Coughlin on, or we can just, you know, ask him how something like that would work. Because, yeah, I could see you can make a very easy – you can make a very good argument that you should be compensated considering the state of your opponent.
Yeah.
And the third fighter on that list that Mark Hunt rattled off, Antonio Silva, but that one's kind of – he's obviously being hyperbolic. Because really, I think when he fought Antonio Silva, he didn't test positive. And even then, when he was on drugs for TRT, which he kind of needs to live. But at the same time, you can make the argument, well, he's not obligated to be a fighter for a living. So, okay. I think that's going to do it for all things news this week. Let's jump in the Wayback Machine. Let's talk all things cinema for 1983. I think I'm going to forego the music unless you really want me to bring it back.
No, you're okay. We'll move on to it.
It was funny for a while. It had its run. Even the last time I did, I was like, okay, this isn't funny anymore. All right. The top 10 movies according to TKO130.com. These are the top 10 films of 1983. Now, this is considering in the box office. So this isn't
quality. This is what it drew at the box office.
We're being objective here. Okay. So at number 10, we have Sudden Impact. Number 9, War Games. Number 8, Jaws 3D. Number 7, Trading Places. Number 6, Flashdance. Number 5, Staying Alive. Number 4, Never Say Never Again, the James Bond movie, obviously. Number 3, Terms of Endearment. Number 2, Octopussy. And at number 1, the Star Wars classic, Return of the Jedi. Now, obviously, for those of you who are listening for the first time, this segment we call Rate and Slate, where we pick out our film that we sort of want to highlight. It's not always necessarily what we consider the best film of this bunch, but something that we want to put a highlight on. And then later on, we talk about Slate, something that, of all the films, that we have to put a negative highlight on it, if you will. But for the sake of our first portion of the segment, we're going to be calling Rate. Now, Dazza, what would be your rate for this year? Because I know we sort of talked to him off air. This is kind of slim pickings.
Yeah, this is a bad year. I mean, there are some. I mean, I'm going to that when we get to the slay, and I'm not going to pick Return of the Jedi, because even though it's sort of, I'm a Star Wars fan and everything, it's not my favorite Star Wars film. It's actually probably my fourth on my list or in ranking of Star Wars films. So I'm not going to pick that one. The one I'm going to pick from this list is actually Trading Places.
Okay. Can't really argue that.
Yeah. Basically because I actually, people always talk about Beverly Hills Cop. I actually think Trading Places, I like Eddie Murphy a lot better in this one. I think it's a really funny film. You know, real good. You know, Dan Aykroyd's great in it. You know, as a comedy, you know, just lots and lots of really good stuff in there. You know, they're both hilarious. It's one of these things that there's like a supporting cast, which is just as hilarious in the stars. This is like sort of, an agent in there who just has a few like, you know, one-liners, which are just like, you know, real, really funny. I mean, there's a whole scene at the end with a sort of concerning a gorilla suit, a guy in a gorilla suit and a real gorilla, which ends up really sort of badly for the guy in the gorilla suit. It's just a really, really funny, you know, film from that period. And, you know, that is the one which I would, which I would go with.
Okay. And for me, obviously, I've exercised it before in the past, the idea of me not picking a rate, but I think this is going to be an exception because most of these films don't set my world on fire. But with that said, I got to go with Return of the Jedi here. obviously, it's not of the original trilogy. I think, and most people will probably agree, it's the weakest of all three of the original entries. But with that said, it's still a really good movie. It's still a classic. It's, you know, I obviously wanted to be here and be the cynical nerd and be like, oh, I don't want to pick this. I'm going to pick something, if not nothing. But really, it's still a really good film. If you told me, Dazzle, we're going to sit down and watch Return of the Jedi, I'd be like, oh, okay, awesome.
Yeah.
So,
I do love Return of the Jedi. Like, so, I mean, the thing is, I've picked two Star Wars films in previous lists. so, you know, Return of the Jedi is kind of, it goes down a bit. One of the things that also sort of bugs me is that people always sort of talk about how it's Darth Vader's redemption. And how he basically sort of, you know, and how he basically sort of, you know, he proves that there's good in him all along and stuff like that. I honestly don't see it like that. Because the only thing that he does is he saves his own son. Mm-hmm. That's all. He's still sort of, you know, a megalomaniac who's sort of, you know, torturing and destroying across the universe and everything. He's basically saved one person who happens to be his son. I mean, I'm sure that Hitler probably loved his son and would have probably sort of, you know, saved, did he have kids? I don't know. Would have basically, you know, saved his son from sort of like, you know, from being killed or something. That doesn't make him a good person. It just meant that he sort of like, you know, loved members of his family. To me, the whole sort of redemption of Vader bit, I never really bought into. You know, because to me, it's still, if he'd have survived, I would have liked to have seen what would have happened next. You know, if it's sort of like, you know, Luke turned up with Vader at the Rebels and said, oh, it's Vader, he's good now and everything. Like, you know, I kind of don't, you know, I never got the big redemption thing.
To answer your question earlier, Hitler never had any kids.
No. Okay. I didn't know. He had dogs, though. He shot, actually.
What's that?
He actually shot his dogs, yeah. When you think
well,
about
you know, he's got to live up to the gimmick, right?
Yeah, so that's a bad example, but I've never been into the big Vader, redemption thing.
Yeah, that sort of plays up to your bit. Obviously, you're quoting the Chris Rock bit. It's like you don't get a redemption story for saving your child. That's what you're supposed to do.
No. Yeah, if it basically turned around and destroyed the Death Star himself, and maybe you know that, but the whole thing that Vader wanted throughout the films was for him and Luke to basically rule the galaxy as father and son. You know, that was his big thing, you know. So, you know, this whole thing that the sort of, like, you know, good in him, it's sort of, you know, I don't buy that. But it is a, you know, a real enjoyable film. You know, if I sort of have as like a Star Wars, you know, marathon anytime, you know, I'll watch that one and will enjoy it and everything. So apart from the fact that I think when they did the special editions, do you remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but they basically re-released the Star Wars films and they basically sort of gone back and redid scenes and everything, you know, and I think of all those special editions, I think Return of the Jedi was the one that they really messed up with the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because they did that really awful singing routine in Jabba's Palace.
Oh, yeah,
didn't fit in. Is it Cy Snootles or something? But it just added CGI into it, which wasn't, you know, in the original, and it just basically just looked really, really out of place and awful, that whole scene.
Yeah, but at the same time, that was my entry to the Star Wars films, because really, had it not been for those re-release of those special editions in the movie theater, I can't guarantee to say, I mean, obviously the idea of not watching a Star Wars film is sort of absurd, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know if I would have watched it had they done that, so.
But they didn't, yeah, but they could have released them and basically just retouched up the film and sort of, you know, do a few things like that. To add an entire, like, really, really bad singing scene, I think was awful. And also later on, they did they added the Vader going, no.
Yeah, they put that. I think they changed.
And they also put in, this was years later, but they also put in Hayden Christian.
Yeah.
In the scene, but, you know, they swapped that around. So I think of all the alterations that they've done, that is probably the one that they sort of tinkered around with the most. And for the most part, I don't think it was. I think they kind of took the film down a few notches by doing that. You know, I think they sort of, you know, they messed around with that way too much.
Interesting story, a little tidbit that I'm not sure if most people know. When when Disney acquired the rights to the Star Wars films, people just assumed, because Disney is often they're the writer of wrongs, people just assumed, oh, they're going to re-release the original trilogy unaltered. Interesting story. Even though Disney bought the rights to Star Wars, they didn't bought the distribution rights to Star Wars. Fox has always been and is currently the holder of the distribution rights to the Star Wars films. So the idea of re-releasing the original trilogy unaltered, that really isn't Fox's court. I didn't know that until I think a couple months ago. Just a little interesting tidbit.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the thing that stopped it before was Lucasfilm. Well, they released them on DVD in the original formats, but they didn't. I don't think they didn't. But there was some. They basically did them like in a really bog standard edition.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't sort of like, you know, they just released them, you know, in sort of like a real, almost like a video format, as opposed to sort of cleaning it up and everything like that. So they did, Lucasfilm did release them quite a few years ago, but I think the thing that always stopped them sort of doing something proper with the original masters was George Lucas. So I think now that Lucasfilm is owned by Disney, I think that they could do a sort of, you know, and I think Fox would be, you know, be quite happy to sort of release those now because, you know, they would basically be profitable because people like me, you know, prefer the unaltered editions. But basically sort of, you know, touched up the print and everything. So it sort of, you know, looks a bit more, you know, vibrant and sort of everything.
I know, but I'm of the opinion that they didn't do it for this recent Star Wars release, and that was a big deal. If people were going to buy Star Wars Blu-rays of the original trilogy unaltered, they probably would have done it then. The fact that they haven't done it now kind of speaks volumes to where they don't feel like there's enough of a market for it, which is kind of sad, but you know, you kind of wish, as someone who enjoys cinema, you would hope that they, and obviously with digital, you can't really make that argument anymore that say there's no market for it. Well, what does it cost you to just retouch the original films and just release it digitally? And I don't know. I can honestly sit here and be like, I have no idea why they haven't since Disney acquired the rights to the Star Wars films. I don't know why they haven't released it. And I'm right there with you. I would love to own that because I'm a big Star Wars guy, obviously. But you know, we haven't seen it, and I'm not holding my breath. Okay. From here, we're going to move on to our slate segment. One of these 10 films that we're going to put in negative spotlight. So for this year, 1983, Dazzle, what's going to be your slate for 1983?
Okay. Well, there's a few pickings. The one I'm going to pick is, and this isn't because as you think I'm a James Bond hater, which I'm not. I'm a James Bond fan. The one I'm going to pick is Never Say Never Again.
Ooh, we are in agreement, but I think we have different reasons. I want to hear your reasons for picking Never Say Never Again.
Well, if you notice, what's weird about this year is that there are two James Bond films. And the reason for this, it's a long, convoluted story of why there are two James Bond films this year. Basically, Never Say Never Again is kind of like almost an unofficial James Bond film when you consider the rest of the James Bond films. Because if you ever watch this film, and I remember watching it as a kid and thinking, this is a bit weird because they don't have the walk on at the start with the sort of, with the eyeball and the sort of James Bond turning to the camera and sort of shooting the camera and that sort of, and the blood coming down. They don't have that because it's not an official line with the regular James Bond films. This film particularly goes back to a long convoluted legal issue concerning the film Thunderball.
Ah, okay.
And basically what it is there was a dispute over who owned the rights to the story for Thunderball. Because Ian Fleming originally wrote it, and someone else, they wrote it as the story as a script to a James Bond film. It never got made. Then he made it into a novel, and then down the path, he basically made it into Thunderball. And so there was a big dispute over who actually owned the rights to the film Thunderball. And in the end, it basically this other studio, I can't remember who it was, they basically ended up with the rights to the story of Thunderball. And what they did as a bit of a coup is they managed to get Sean Connery to come back to fill the role of sort of James Bond in this film.
So
that's why the base of the story is basically pretty much the same story as Thunderball. If you know the whole story, it's exactly the same story. And they just had to they gave it a different name. But yeah, it is basically it's kind of like a rogue. What do we used to call it in the wrestling days when it's sort of an outlaw territory, as it were? This is kind of like an outlaw James Bond film. You know, it doesn't fit in with the rest of the canon. And to be perfectly honest, you know, it is to me, it doesn't feel like a James Bond film. The opening credits are really, really awful. You know, Sean Connery was well past it by now. Everything about it just doesn't feel right as a film in general. It's just pretty awful. And I basically, hated this movie. I absolutely despised it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And for me, as far as my slate, I'm right there with you. But I think I have different reasons. Obviously, not a good film. I'm not going to sit here and try to defend the movie and say it's not so bad. No, I'm specifically picking this film because it's bad. But there's an added reason why I'm adding this to my slate. Now, obviously, I've had cable for a while now. Now, if anyone knows where I'm going with this, I don't know what is it I don't know, and I'm not sure which specific cable stations it is, but it seems like this movie's always playing. And I remember one summer I must have watched this movie about 10 times just because it was on and there was nothing else to watch, and I was like, I'm just going to have it on and play in the background, but I'm not really going to watch it. But it's like, I don't know why this film, of all the James Bond films, this is the one that, and even Basic Cable, it's like, I don't know why Basic Cable just loves this film. Just if they have a two-hour window for whatever reason why, oh, let's just play Never Say Never Again for no reason. And it's like, first of all the James Bond films, this one, and really, you have nothing else on. It's like you have this wealth of programming and you're just going to keep showing Never Say Never Again. So I must have seen this movie about 20 times. So for me, it's not enough that this film is awful for me to put it on my slate. And really, that's justification of alone. But this is personal for me. I've had to sit through this movie so many times. So for me, I'm gonna do this with passion. This is gonna be my slate. Now before we've done this before in the past where I've either elected to not do slate, or I do slate and I kind of do it half hearted. This is the one I'm doing with passion, with gusto. So I'm glad this is why we have slate, because And that was the thing when we started doing the James Bond films. I'm like, oh, eventually we're going to get to Never Say Never Again. And I'm going to get to roast it. Because, man, I hate that film.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the cable thing is like in America. I'm guessing maybe the reason why you see this film quite a lot is probably because it's cheap. It's cheap to get. And it's basically, it's a James Bond film. So it sort of, like, you know, has that sort of, you know, the James Bond thing. But I'm guessing it's basically cheaper to basically get this one as opposed to getting one of the actual, you know, the proper, you know, James Bond films.
So bad.
Yeah. But yeah, it is really bad. I mean, it's got Kim Basinger as the, as a Bond girl in it. It's got, I think it's got,
and that stupid game.
Oh god, the computer thing.
Oh god, the computer game that when you're losing it hurts you and it's like you could die potentially playing this game. I'm like, no.
And it's also got Mr. Bean in it.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Yeah.
No, you know what I mean? You have Mr. Bean in America. You know who Mr.
Yeah,
Bean is.
Yeah, you know what? In fact, I was bringing this up earlier. There's been news reports as of late alleging that he's committed suicide, even though it's not true. So sort of mimicking what I think it was a couple years ago when people were reporting Jackie Chan was dead.
Right. Okay. Okay. But yeah. He's in it. He plays like a comedy character. It's just watching this as a film. I think Sean Connery's one of the reasons why he did this film, obviously, but you know, the money aspect of it, but I think he'd had a falling out with the people who basically did the regular James Bond films. And so one of the reasons why he sort of did it was to basically pretty much stick it to them is what I heard. You know, it was so there's kind of like a with all the legal issues and with that sort of mean spirit behind it, this is, you know, there is a, you know, this is kind of just like, you know, a really, you know, poor, you know, sort of, a poor, you know, James Bond film in there. And there is actually a book about the whole sort of, you know, the battle for over this film, because it was such, you know, such a long protracted affair and everything, you know.
Okay. From here, we are going to move on to something we've since added to this list. Obviously, talking, I feel like we should do it now more than ever, since we're talking about how awful movies can be, the terrible side of movies. Now, we're going to pick our slate picks and compare them to what was the Razzies for that year. Obviously.
Well, we do the Oscars first.
Are you sure? Because I feel like we're talking the worst.
Okay, well, let's go into the Razzies.
How bad movies can be. And you know what? Okay. This seems like a better time than ever. Let's just talk the Razzies. Let's just get it out of our system. So once we talk the Razzies, we can just go back to talking about how great films can be. We'll talk the best picture. But we're going to go over the Razzies for, and obviously if you're listening to this for the first time, we're doing 1983, but with the awards, especially when we go to the Academy Awards, they always do it for the year after. So we're going to be doing the Razzies for 1984. Daz, do you have it pulled out in front of you?
I don't know.
It's okay. I'll go off the nominees for Worst Picture. I'll start from the bottom. I'll go up, and then I'll reveal what won Worst Film. Okay. Jaws 3D. Obviously, this was on the top 10 list.
Oh yeah, remember as well, we have the confession aspect to this, where if we like one of these films, we have to confess that I'm
curious to see if this may apply to this week.
Yeah, okay. Jaws 3D is not one that I will confess to, because that is an awful film. That is, you know, I mean, it's weird as those films went on, the shark got more and more ridiculous looking.
Yes, so I've heard from Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Okay, we have Hercules, the 1983 remake of it from MGM and Canon Films. Stroker Ace. Never heard this.
Wait, what was that one?
Stroker Ace from Warner Brothers / Universal.
I've never heard of that one.
Neither have I. The Lonely Lady from Universal. And for Worst Pictures for 1983, another nominee, Two of a Kind from 20th Century Fox. And obviously the winner of this bunch is The Lonely Lady. You heard this film, Dazza?
No, I've just looked up Stroker Ace, and Stroker Ace was a car racing film with Burt Reynolds, where he played a NASCAR driver, which I watched a lot of Burt Reynolds films in my time, and I don't remember that one at all, but it looked, Burt Reynolds at this time just seemed to do car movies. That seemed to be his big thing. But yeah, I don't know that one. Lonely Lady is, it looks like an erotica movie.
Ooh, I may want to reconsider this list.
I'm just looking. It stars Pia Zadora, who is basically the star of Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. And she got a Golden Raspberry as Worst Actress as well for a film called Butterfly, it looks like. Oh, no, she... okay. I'm just having a look what the film is actually about. It just looks like a... It just looks like a thriller stroke piece of erotica. So it looks like the sort of, I guess it looks like the sort of the 50 Shades of Grey of its time.
I may have to watch this film and report back.
also starred a young Ray Liotta. I don't know much about this film. It says it was heavily panned by critics. It was nominated for 11 Golden Raspberry Awards and won 6 of them.
Ooh.
Worst Actress, Worst Director, Worst Musical Score, Worst Original Song, Worst Picture, and Worst Screenplay. It was also nominated for a Razzie as Worst Picture of the Decade. And nominated as worst drama of the first of the Razzie's first 25 years. It lost to Battlefield Earth.
It lost to wait. Does that mean Battlefield Earth was worse than this?
Yes.
When you're dealing with the worst, it's like, how does that work with the? Is it worse to not win or is it worse to lose?
You to lose basically means you didn't. You're not the worst.
You weren't
so,
bad
enough.
Yeah,
I know what you're getting at. Oh, something else. This Pierre Zadora, she was nominated for Worst Actress of the Century.
Ooh.
But lost to Madonna.
Go figure.
Yeah.
And to sort of bring it back into 1983, funny you should bring up Pierre Zadora because she won Worst Actress for 1984.
Right. So... yeah, I'm just looking at the synopsis. Yeah, this looks basically like a doesn't sound like she is very lonely because it sounds like she basically has lots of sex and takes lots of drugs throughout this thing.
I may have to watch and report back now.
you watch this, and watch the green room as well, which you promised to do.
The green
behind
room
behind the green door.
Ooh,
remember that one?
I don't.
that was when we came across. That was like one of these porn films from the '70s. The one with the 11-minute flying sperm segment.
Oh, that's so. This is another film to put on the list.
Yeah, this is another one. It looks a stinker.
Okay, other notables. I feel like we're just going to quickly go through this because I feel like we've talked at length about this. Worst actor goes to Christopher Atkins in Night in Heaven. Interesting note, we've added part of the thing when we do the Razzies. Notable entries in this. People who were nominated for Worst Actor in his first cinematic role, Lou Ferrigno as Hercules. He won for Worst New Star. And another notable will be John Travolta in Staying Alive. So, when you see like things like this, it's like, well, are people just being catty and just nominating people for Worst Actor? But yeah, that's 1983. That's the fourth Golden Raspberries Awards for these films. All right, let's go on to what... Now let's we've seen the worst that films can provide. Let's move on to the best. Now since we're talking all films for 1983, let's see what won Best Picture in 1984. Best Picture 1984. Terms of Endearment.
Ah.
There you go. None of our picks for Rate.
But it did, that was in the top 10. It was number 3.
Yeah, but the thing is, neither of us picked it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've even seen that, to be honest.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a classic. Obviously, won Best Picture in 1984. I haven't heard of it. Maybe this is me.
I've heard of it, but it's a film I don't think I've ever actually got around to watching.
One of the things I'm glad about this show is it highlights all these great films and like we discussed earlier, all these bad films. So I'm kind of glad because I have this show as a resource. It's like, oh, I wouldn't mind checking out that film. I wouldn't mind checking out that film. This is a film that I really probably should check out.
It's got a good cast. It's got Shirley MacLaine, Jack Nicholson, Deborah Winger, Danny DeVito, John Lithgow, Jeff Daniels.
So, I'm sure there are people that are listening right now and screaming at us. It's like, how can you have not seen Terms of Endearment? You guys have lost all legitimacy with me.
Yeah.
All right. As we very quickly start to wrap this up, Daz, I know you attended various shows and whatnot on your Vegas excursion. Have you been reading or watching anything as of late that we should, since we're talking films, have you been watching anything as of late that we should check out?
I have not been to the cinema. While I've been away, I'm planning to see quite a few films this week because there's a lot I want to catch up on. One of which is Ghostbusters, which I do want to see what that is like. you know, because I actually sort of mentioned about this when I went to see Independence Day, that I it was hard to imagine that Ghostbusters would be worse than Independence Day. And from a lot of the reviews that I've heard about it, are surprisingly not a great film, but, you know, not the disaster that people have been making out with. So I'll be going to see that this week, so to try and make up my own mind. And I also want to see a bit of Star Trek Beyond that comes out this week, so I'm going to try and see those films. I have actually been reading. I've not had a chance to get to a comic shop or anything, but I have been reading a book which ties into what we've been talking about earlier, called How Star Wars Conquered the World, mm-hmm. by Chris Taylor. And this is a really good book. It's the history of the Star Wars franchise. But each chapter is interspersed with another chapter, which will basically talk about a different aspect of Star Wars fandom. So you've basically got stuff about, like, sort of conventions. You've got stuff about the merchandise. So it's basically just a really good examination on all things Star Wars. You know, a really good book. But it's also like the history of the making of the film, and it's just amazing when you actually read it. As it's one of those Star Wars is one of those films that you see as being sort of like, you know, just this massive success that came along, and it's amazing that the film ever actually got made, because the amount of problems that they had making it, you know, they went over budget. The studio had absolutely no faith in it whatsoever. They basically originally it was only supposed to get into so many theaters, because there was another film that year, I think it might have been The Sorcerer or something, that was basically seen as basically being, you know, Fox's big hit for the year. So Star Wars was kind of just sort of, you know, relegated to originally to the secondary cinemas. It's just an amazing book when you read about it, and just sort of seeing, you know, just how sort of, you know, how many difficulties there were in actually getting the film onto the screen. A lot of the people making it, you know, particularly when they sort of, you know, wrapped up in England and everything, just thought this film was going to be a complete and utter mess, you know, because they couldn't envision what they'd filmed as being basically, you know, tied into, you know, as being tied together into anything which would be, you know, in any way comprehensible, you know, as a movie. So there's a really famous story as well, apparently, when, Fox demanded to see, you know, what Lucas had basically come up with. And Lucas had basically, he'd not managed to get anywhere near doing any of the special effects. So he basically showed them the film. And what he did in the scenes that should have been spaceships, he basically just put in like World War II fighter footage, just to sort of show this is the kind of thing that I was doing. And the Fox people basically just walked out and just had this thing of like, you know, this is a mess. You know, and it's just amazing when you read about it, but just sort of, you know, how what we actually got at the cinema. It's amazing that this film has changed cinema forever in so many ways. It's just amazing that we actually ever managed to, you know, to get this film made.
Yeah, it's one thing to obviously in hindsight be like, oh, how did they not know? I'm sure if you would put us in that exact same situation, we probably would have thought the same thing.
And plus as well, what you've got to realize is that the early drafts were pretty much terrible, you know, but the stuff that, you know, they're pretty much, you know, really, really different to what we've got. The actual, you know, the original George Lucas, you know, the scripts needed a lot of sort of, you know, work on them.
Yeah. And I don't know if I saw the scripts or I saw a couple of people, I think it was like Mark Hamill or Harrison Ford doing their screen test, and they're reading the script and it's, you know, reminiscent of what we finally got in the final product, but I'm just like, I hear what they're saying. They're reading off the script. I'm like, this sounds terrible.
Well, Harrison, there's a famous quote that Harrison Ford said to George Lucas, and it was something along the lines of, "You can write this shit, but you can't say it." You know, and that is pretty much sort of, you know, that is pretty much how it was seen at the time. And people, you know, they didn't, you know, think for a minute that this film would ever be, you know, would amount to anything. You know, it was such a, you know, number of times that they almost pulled the plug and it was, incredible.
Yeah, and there's so many things you've heard of it. Obviously, wasn't it the story going around that originally he wanted to produce a Flash Gordon film and he wasn't able to get the rights?
Yeah, that is, you know, originally that was his sort of, you know, intention. He wanted to make a Flash Gordon movie. You know, he wanted to make, you know, because he grew up with the old sort of black and white serials and everything. And that's what he wanted to make. And there was just no way that he could get the rights. So he basically sort of, you know, created his own sort of, you know, universe and everything.
Go ahead.
But you know, like I say, it's just sort of, you know, just, you know, it's just an amazing book, and I'm also to halfway, you know, through it. But it's just, you know, it's a really interesting. I mean, there's even a chapter that basically goes into all the once Star Wars came out. There's a chapter which is basically all the cash-ins, you know, and all the films like in Italy that were basically just sort of complete and utter rip-offs of Star Wars and everything, like, you know. But the, you know, even covers all those types of films, like, you know. So it's just a really, really comprehensive, you know, sort of book.
Yeah, and I don't want to make the show just all these little Star Wars trivia facts. In fact, I'm looking to wrap this thing up. But really, obviously, another thing that's become since legendary since the film came out. Remember the one of the things of the films they wanted, like a sort of a contemporary of the time soundtrack, sort of, you know, reflect the times, and they were kind of critical of Lucas of going in the direction of like a classical score. People were like, well, it's like, you know, we kind of want it to be of the times. The idea that you're going to do a movie like this with a classic orchestra, it's like, well, I don't know if that's one of those things you want to do in this film. And it's one of those things to where, in hindsight, I don't know if the film would have been as good or it would have been as timeless if you had something that reflected the times. I mean, you had the idea of having this orchestra and a classic soundtrack. You know, it really made the film pop.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the Star Wars, you know, the theme that base, I think that made it, you know, timeless. You know, that sort of, you know, that music. I mean, they really looked upon having, you know, John Williams in there. You know, to me, there's sort of there's three people that were like really, really instrumental in the sort of the success of Star Wars. Obviously, it was George Lucas for having the actual, you know, vision in the first place. It was Ralph McQuarrie who basically did a lot of the sort of, you know, the concept art and the designs of the characters and everything like that. And the other one is, you know, and I think probably of the three, probably the one who was the most iconic is John Williams, because his score is you know, is amazing. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, to me, that basically says, you know, if you hear that music, if you just hear a couple of bars of that, that it just says Star Wars to you straight away, you know, and that to me is like, you know, they really, you know, as in, you know, the score to me is important. The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, you know, they will play Star Wars. You know, I've actually been to see, you know, to see the show that they basically play. But we have something in the UK called the Proms, which is basically sort of like a month or so of sort of the Royal Albert Hall, basically just like, you know, it's like a classical music festival. And, you know, they will have sort of like a night of like, of moving music, you know, and Star Wars will always be like, you know, the highlight of the thing, because it's, you know, it's just like that incredible stirring music.
Yeah, so that's one of those things that you're like, you know, in hindsight, who would have ever predicted all these things that would have come from Star Wars or helped make the Star Wars film so legendary? Just really cool.
Yeah, but like I said, this is it's called How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, and it is a, you know, a really good, you know, really in-depth book. It's not sort of something like this sort of like light little, you know, sci-fi piece that you'll sometimes get with sort of like movies. This is like, you know, a really, really, you know, well written, really good book.
Okay. Unless there's anything else you want to do, I think we're going to wrap up this week's show, Dazzle.
No, I'm done.
we're playing catch up after taking those 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
All right. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out this week's show. And as always, see you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.